Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
It's pretty good. Like Tony said, Pastor Tony said, I've been here many, many times. It's the first time I've been here, this place, in this spot. Usually I'm up there somewhere. Do y'all know how blessed you are? I mean, I know you do, but sometimes, like, you see things a little bit differently on the outside, you know, because you're maybe not as used to it. I mean, I love this church. I really do. I'm not just saying that because I'm here and not just saying that so ahead of time you already think something good about me. So no matter what I say after this, you're like, well, you know, at least he loves our church. Right? So that's not what I'm doing. But, I mean, you're so blessed here. Right? I mean, you just really are. You got a great staff. I mean, Brother Tony and I getting to know each other better all the time. I'm one of my closest friends in the world down here and leads music for you. And all these great musicians who give their time and Bronson and Don and then sort of forgotten guys back there in the back who make this place sound so awesome every single week. Right? I mean, these guys are great. Trust me. We play in lots of places. We play music in lots of places and sound is not always good. Here it's always can't get better. And those guys give their time every single week. And then I know many of you personally. But anyway, I'm glad to be here. I love being here. I told Tony this morning, if y'all could move this church about 15 minutes closer to Louisville, I would probably come here. You might say, can't you just get up 15 minutes earlier? And the answer to that is no, I can't. Just ask my wife, who we were talking about the very thing the other day. I don't know if you've seen this. There's these clocks now that they go off and they jump off your dresser and they run around your room. You got to find it. Why it's going on, right? It's not alive or anything. It just bounces all over the place. And then there's another clock that goes off. You've got to do a math problem. Now, I mean, I would never leave that. I'd just throw that out the window. So I'd have to buy a new clock every day. But anyway, I'm really glad to be here. I just wanted to let you know that. First of all, there's a typo in the sermon. It's 1 Peter chapter 5. Whoever wrote this sermon and this outline made a typo right off the bat. I'll have to figure out who did that and sent it up here. But it is 1 Peter chapter 5, verses 6 through 7. And usually I preach from a bigger text than this. It's just two verses. But there's a lot here. There's a lot here. And that's what we're just going to focus on, sort of two verses. And the title of my sermon, you may see, is called How to Be Humble. Right? It's kind of weird to get up in front of people and say, I'm going to preach to you about how to be humble. Right, I told my wife, she said, what's your sermon title? I said, How to Be Humble. She said, is that right? And I said, yeah, it is. You got a problem with that or something? And she's like, no. You should, though. And so anyway, I'm kidding, kind of. Anyway, it's hard to get up in front of people and preach how to be humble because you're feeling like, well, that's kind of a weird thing to tell people. But I just want to tell you right off the bat, I'm not preaching at you. I'm here open the Word with you. And that what I desire is what this text, what Peter desires as his readers, I desire for you and for myself. And that is we learn what it means to be humble. That's a word we use all the time, right? Every Christian knows the word humble or humility. And we talk about need to be humble, we need to have humility in our lives. But what do we mean by it? We have all these sort of Christian words that we use and we throw them around all the time. But if somebody came up to you and just say, like on the street or wherever you are, tomorrow and said, hey, you're a Christian, what does it mean to be humble? What would you say? Like exactly what would you say? Now, I'm sure you'd say some good things. I'm sure you'd say some great things. I'm positive about it. But what does Peter have? Why does Peter say this? And why does he say it here? This is near the end of the letter, and he's writing to people who are suffering. I mean, they're really suffering. And they're suffering for the sake of Jesus because they're believers in a culture that just is as opposite of being Christian as it possibly can be. We recognize that our culture is not a Christian culture, but, man, it's a lot closer. Close, it doesn't really count. But that world they lived in the first century, it was nowhere near. Nobody knew what Christianity was. It had no influence anywhere, any shape or form, at any level in society. Nowhere. And so these people are being persecuted for their belief in Jesus. And Peter gets to the end of his letter, near the end, and says, humble yourself. That seems like a weird thing to say to people who are suffering. Right? I mean, they're suffering. Why do they need some, an apostle? Why do they need one of these apostles to come and say, you need to humble yourself? So what we want to do is ask ourselves, so what's Peter up to here? Why is he telling these people in particular, these people who are suffering, why is he saying to you, to them, humble yourself? And what does that mean for us? How is God speaking to us in this text? So what I'm going to do here is I'm going to start at the beginning of the chapter and read just get us into it. I'll start at the beginning of chapter 5, and then we'll get started. So I exhort the elders among you, as a fellow elder and a witness of the sufferings of Christ, as well as a partaker in the glory that is going to be revealed. And that's important. Look at what Peter says. He's already taking part in the glory that's going to be. It's not just pie in the sky later. That's really important. The glory to be revealed. We're already experiencing that, according to Peter. Shepherd the flock of God that is among you, exercising oversight, not under compulsion, but willingly as God would have you. Not for shameful gain, but eagerly, not domineering over those in your charge, but being examples to the flock. And when the chief shepherd appears, you will receive the unfading crown of glory. Likewise, so he's talked to the leaders there, then he speaks to the younger people. Likewise, you who are younger, be subject to the elders. And now he speaks to everybody in the church. Leaders, lay people, whoever. You got whatever you got in that church, he's speaking to them. Clothe yourselves, all of you, with humility toward one another. For God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Now, here's our text. Humble yourselves, therefore. Why? Because God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God, so that at the proper time he may exalt you, casting all your anxieties on him, because he cares for you. What do we mean by being humble? Many decades ago, over 100 years ago, somebody was looking at kind of our culture and said this. Every day, more and more, one comes across somebody who says, my view may not be the right opinion because he's too humble. But of course, his view must be the right one or it wouldn't be his view. Why else would he hold it? We're on the road to producing people too modest and humble to believe in the multiplication table. We're in danger of creating people who think the law of gravity is just a matter of personal opinion and not one they would force on others. In older times, people were too proud to be convinced, but today, we're too humble to be convinced of anything. And so that is true, right? That's the kind of humility. The kind of humility you say, well, I'm not going to say what you're saying is wrong. Who am I? Right? There was a time, I suppose, where the most famous verse in the Bible is John 3:16. Now everybody, we sort of joke about it, but it's true. Now the most famous quoted verse in the New Testament is Matthew 7:1. You know what that is? Judge not, lest ye be judged. I just said ye. All of a sudden King James, and I don't know where that came from. But anyway, judge not so that you won't be judged. And we whip that out all the time, right? Usually wrong. Because, of course, that text is not saying don't ever judge at all. Right? It's not saying you better not judge or God's going to get you. Of course, what it's saying is you better be careful when you judge because you'll be judged in the same sort of way. It's Jesus saying you need to make right judgments. Not no judgment. You need to make right judgments. But the way we use it and the way it's used in the world is you better not judge anything anybody does because that's arrogant and proud. Right? So there is that, and we do suffer from that in the church. But there's a bigger thing that I think sometimes we think of humility, and that is we think of humility as just kind of something like, well, really, the like a character trait of some kind. Like being quiet, right? Like a quiet, reserved person. They're the humble people in church. And they might be, but they might not be. They might be quiet because they don't really want to know or care what you think or say. Right? They might think they're too good for you, so they're quiet all the time. So being quiet, it might be humble, it might not be. Right? They might just be reserved. But the thing is there's the kind of humility Peter's talking about, not one single one of you has it naturally, and neither do I. He's not talking about something that you just get out of the box. And some of you have more than others. That's not what he's talking about. Because what he's talking about is not something that we're naturals at. Not something that comes to us as natural. Now, some people are more reserved, and some people are more quiet, and some people sort of, you know, and it, you know, there's a way of saying it. Some people are, you know, more humble. That's true. But that's not what Peter's getting at. He's not just talking about you need to be quiet, you need to keep your mouth shut, you need to listen more. All those things are true, but that's not what he's talking about. Why would you need to tell a whole bunch of people who are suffering, you know what y'all need to do is just sort of, you just need to be more reserved and quiet, generally speaking. And just, you know, let other people do the talking. That's good. That's good. But why tell people who are suffering, you just need to sort of ratchet it down some? Right? It seems sort of, you know, salt in the wound. They're already suffering. That comes up and says, you need to be humble. You know? Come on. I know you're suffering, but you need to be humble. Not really. I don't think that's what's going on. So let's see what's happening here. Well, the how-to part, this is called how to be humble. The how-to part is to warn you. That didn't really come to the end. Right? So you need to hang on for that. We'll just start where Peter starts. And where Peter starts is an unusual place for all of us, because Peter doesn't start with us, he starts with God. And sort of what we figure is anything we need to do or anything we need to fix, we've got to start with ourselves. What do I need to do? That's a pretty good question, but unfortunately for Christians, we ask that question way too much. What do I need to do? Now, I'm not saying we don't have responsibilities, but you will never know what you need to do unless you begin with God and who He is and where He is. And that's how it starts right here, right? Right off the bat. Humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God. So the first thing is really simple. Really simple. It's a really simple beginning. That is, we can't begin with ourselves. We have to begin with God. Now, we're not good at this. We're not good at this at all. In fact, ever since Adam on down, there has been nobody born who didn't want to begin everything with themselves and end everything with themselves and fill up all the middle stuff with themselves. It's true of every single one of you. It's true of me. That's how we are. We're not naturally born in our fallen state, in the sin that we're born in. We're not born to look outside of ourselves for help. In fact, we're even taught you shouldn't do that. You've got to look out for number one. You've got to help yourself. And then you have that thing people think is in the Bible, right? God helps those who help themselves. But that's nowhere near the Bible. In fact, it's the opposite of what the Bible teaches. Right? So we can't begin with ourselves, because if we do, we're going to fail. And we all know what that's like. So we have to begin with God. And that's where Peter begins. He says, humble yourselves, but then he tells them what he's all about, or what he's getting at. So that's point one. It's really short. All right? We're already done with the first point. I can't guarantee you all the next are going to be as short as that, but we're on our way anyway. All right? So that's step one, right? We love steps. So here's step one. Here you go. Begin with God. Okay, we're done. Now, the second thing is, this might sound weird if you read the text, is we need to not just begin with God, but we have to submit to God. Specifically, submit to God's power in our lives. You think, where's that come from? Right? Where's that come from in the text? Well, it comes from this one phrase, under the mighty hand of God. Now, why does Peter choose this phrase? What is the mighty, when you hear that, what do you think? Where does he get this? Well, I think Peter gets it from the Old Testament. Because in the Old Testament, I won't read every single one of these texts, but Job says, "Shall we not? We receive everything good from God. Shall we receive good at the hand of God, but not also bad things?" The writer Ecclesiastes says, "Food and drink and work—it all comes from God's hand." So there's this acknowledgement in the Old Testament, in the New Testament too, that if you have anything good, whatever you have in your life, it's because God gave it to you by His own hand. And that's true. But I don't think that's exactly what Peter means here by the mighty hand of God. Here's what I think he means. Remember, he's writing to people who are suffering. Always keep that in your mind. In Exodus 3, God speaks to Moses. You know the story. Right? God appears and speaks in the burning bush. And he says, I know that the king of Egypt will not let you go unless a mighty hand compels him. So I will stretch out my hand and strike the Egyptians with all the wonders that I will perform among them. After that, he's going to let you go. So there it is. There's that phrase that Peter uses. The mighty hand of God. And then later, Moses is reminding the Israelites of everything that happened to them, right? Because they don't really have, right from the very beginning, they don't have a very good history of relying on God. And in Deuteronomy, several years later, Moses reminds them, and he says, you'll remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God brought you out of there by a mighty hand and by an outstretched arm. I think that's what's behind what Peter's talking about. This mighty hand of God is the power of God to save. It's the power of God to rescue. It's the power of God to help. Not the power of God to swat you down, right? You might think of, sometimes we think of God that way. We think of God as like some kind of like really mean school principal. Just follow us around. I'm going to get you. The minute you, I can't wait. Right? We think of God this way. You know, well, you know why? Because we think of God being like us. We're just going to, I know you're going to mess up. I can't wait till you do, because when you do, I'm going to jump all over you. And we think of God that way. Like, God's just behind the corner. And like, it's just a matter of time. I got you right. And as soon as you mess up, I'm going to be all over you. And we think of God that way. The thing is God's not like that at all. We might be, and we often are, but that's not how God is. So the mighty hand of God is not God's hand over top of you that's getting ready to crush you the minute you mess up. Right? So if that's what comes to your mind, you think of God's hand, like, man, he's the all-powerful God of the universe, and he's going to jump me if I don't get my stuff in order. Right? I better humble myself or God's going to beat me down. Now, God does correct us because he's our Father. But Peter's here not saying, he's not warning them. You better humble yourself or boom, hammer's going to fall on you. No. That's not how God is. We think of him that way. I had in junior high, I had this class called, it was a wood shop. Now, you might not know, I don't know if they even still have wood shop or not, but in West Virginia, we have wood shop. And so what wood shop is a bunch of 13-year-old boys with gigantic power tools everywhere. And they're all on, like, table saw, bandsaw, lathe, jigsaw, you name it. You know, whatever kind of saw that you can lose your hand and fingers and face or whatever else is there. And you got 13-year-old boys jumping all around them or want to use all of them. So shop teacher needs to be somebody who's kind of in control. And we had such a shop teacher. His name was Mr. Armstrong. We all called him Mr. A. And he is one of the biggest men I've ever known in my entire life. And not only was he a big man, he had a big paddle. Now, some of you kids in school, you might be, what's that? Right? Now, some of you will know what a paddle is because you've been receiving into one several times. I myself have basically signed my name, as it were, on Mr. Armstrong's paddle, though not in ink. And so, not only did Mr. Armstrong have a huge paddle, it had holes in it. And you're like, what do you have holes in it for? So to go faster. Right, that's what makes a paddle. I mean, it's bad enough to have this gigantic guy with a piece of oak that's getting ready to break you in half. Now, I know some of you are like, that's awful. Well, I mean, it was awful, trust me. Right? It's more awful than you can imagine. But, you know, I'm still here today, and it didn't really kill me or it didn't affect me for life as far as I know. It did keep me from getting my hand cut off, I guess. But anyway, it had holes in it, and he did no chances with Mr. Arm. The minute you mess up, you're out in the hallway, and everybody gets at the door. You don't even need to get to the door. In fact, you could go to another building down the street and hear the contact of that paddle and the wind. And I don't care who you are, how tough you think you are, how many people you've beat up in your life, whatever you can take, you were not able to take Mr. Armstrong's paddle. Nobody could stand it and not cry. And you just cried. You start crying before. Right? Before as soon as you stand up, you're crying already. You see like the biggest football players in school, and they're already crying. They're not even in the hallway yet. It just humbled everybody. But you know what? That's not what God was like. It's not what God is like. God's not waiting to paddle you the minute you mess up. Because God knows you mess up. He knows better than anybody. God's mighty hand is that same hand that reached out and parted the Red Sea. Think about this for a minute. The same hand that reached out and parted the Red Sea is the same hand that reaches out and says to you, I'm here to help you. I'm here for you. And if you think, in the New Testament, what do you think about God's right hand or God's mighty hand? It's where Jesus sits enthroned as King of the whole universe. That's the power that's in store for you. That's the power that is on your side. Not to jump all over you and kick you down the street or kick you when you're down, but to pick you up and to hold you and to keep holding you. That's what God's mighty hand is. There's never been a time where God's mighty hand was not stretched out to help His people. That's what He does. That's why He does it. And if you don't believe He does it, He did it exactly. That's exactly what He did in Jesus. That's God's power to save His people, and you see it no better than that Jesus on the cross died for our sins. And that's where we have to begin. And we have to submit to that power. And that's the greatest thing you can do. The greatest thing you can do is to submit to that and think, yeah, that's what I need. Because I can't start with myself. You can't. You can't do it. I don't care how tough you are. I don't care what you've done, what you're able to do, how self-reliant you are. You cannot fix yourself. You can't. Not one single one of you can. And you know how you know? And you know you can. Because you've never been able to. Not fully. And you know what I'm talking about. And don't get me wrong. Don't get me wrong. I'm not for one second saying anything about hard work. I'm not talking about any. I'm not trying to denigrate or make fun of anybody who's made something of themselves out of nothing. My own dad grew up in a place called Boone County, West Virginia. You've probably never heard of it. He grew up in a place called Blooming Rose. And he grew up, and I'm not kidding, he had one pair of shoes a year, 10 brothers and sisters, and worked every day of his life and ate cornbread for lunch every day at school and got made fun of every day. And he ended up being a businessman who was in business, ran an auto shop. He ran the same auto shop for 45 years. I said 43 earlier. 45 years. I understand completely. You have no idea how much I respect that kind of hard work. That's not what I'm talking about. All I'm saying is, that does not transfer then into us being tough and being able to handle our own problems. When my dad was lying on his deathbed dying of cancer, this big tough man, who's the sweetest guy I've ever known, this big tough man was not able to fix that. There was no amount of work he could do to stop that cancer from eating up his body. Not one thing he could do. And he was one of the toughest men I'll ever know. He couldn't stop it. He couldn't, but he died in his bed singing hymns and reading the Bible and praying because he knew who was on his side. So don't get me wrong, I'm not talking against hard work or how hard you work. All I mean is that you cannot finally ultimately fix yourself, but God can, and He says, I'm here for you. The mighty hand of God, it's good. It's a good hand. It's good. He's here for your good. He's there for your good. And so that's the second thing, is we have to submit to that power. It's the infinite power of the God who created the universe. That same power is available for your life. You believe that? God who created something out of nothing, that is the, it's not different. The power that He has in store for you and available to you and that He's working in your life is that same power. There's nothing He can't do. Nothing. Problem is we don't believe it. Another problem is we want to keep trying to do it ourselves. In spite of our perfect track record of total failure. I'll do it this time. Shoulder to the wheel. Is that right? Shoulder to the wheel. Nose to the grindstone. I'll do it. No, you won't. And you're the living proof that you won't. And even if you talk tough, you know what happens when you shut the light off at night. You know what happens in here when the lights go off and you're there by yourself. I don't care how many things you're not afraid of in life. You might not be afraid of anything, but when those lights go off and you're by yourself, you know what you're afraid of. You know what you're afraid of the next day. You know there's all kinds of things you can't control. And the God of the universe says, I've got it. Whatever it is, I can handle it. And He reaches out His arm, His hand, and says, hey, I'm here for you. I'm here for you. That's what I did. And so that's the second thing, submit to God's power. But we have to understand what that power is. Now the third thing is, we have to understand there's a promise here. There's a promise here, because look what He says. So at the proper time, He might exalt you. That's the end of verse 6. So what Peter says to them is, look, humble yourself under the mighty hand of God. He's going to save you. Just like He told Moses, I'm going to come and save those folks. He did. And then God later said, hey, remember I saved you. Just like I told you I would. And that's what we have to do. We have to understand this is a promise. You have to understand that there is nothing at no time in any place in the Christian life, there's nothing you can go through that God is not one day and ultimately going to make right. That's why Peter talks about the future all the time. Right from the very beginning, right from chapter 1. Go read it this afternoon. It'll take you a few minutes. He starts talking about our salvation that's going to appear when Jesus appears. Because Peter, like the rest of the New Testament, doesn't think of salvation as just like the moment you made a decision sometime in the past. He looks at the whole thing and says, you know what? The moment you came to Jesus by faith, at that very moment, you already were the inheritor of all of eternity in heaven. It was all yours, all at once. From that moment. That's why he says earlier, remember I pointed out earlier, when he talks about, where'd it go? Partaker in the glory that is going to be revealed. We're already taking part in it. Because he understands that the Christian life is all about the future sort of being today. Because that's why he's calling them to faith. That you need to believe that God's hand is stretched out to help you, because everything around you will say, I don't think so. But we have to believe that this day is coming where God's going to make it all right. But it's not just pie in the sky one day. It's now. By faith. That doesn't make all your anxieties and problems go away. But by faith, it hands them to God. And I'll talk more about that in a minute. But that's really important for you to understand. What is Christian faith? Christian faith is this. It is strength and living in the present because God's perfect track record in the past, which guarantees the future. That's what it is. The Christian faith is always lived sort of a three-way crossroads. You live in the present. And in the present, you know of God's perfect track record, everything that God's done for you perfectly in Jesus. And that guarantees that whatever God has promised, He will do. And so you can be empowered to live now by faith. Not by sight, but by faith. And that's what He's saying to them. You know, this day is coming. So He's not just saying, look, you just put up with some stuff right now and just one of these days it'll be over. You just deal with it now. It's going to be horrible. It's going to be hard. But one day you'll wake up in heaven and it'll all go away. Now, there's a certain, I wouldn't put it that way, but there's a certain amount of what I said is true. But He's not just saying, you know, one day don't worry about it. You know, it's awful now. I get it. And it's not just, whew, man, I'm glad that's over. Though we feel that way sometimes. What Peter is saying is, you have to understand that glory that you're going to experience fully is already yours right now in the midst of all that junk in your life that looks like anything but glory. And what he's doing is he's calling them to believe in the midst of everything that would say to them, it's a load of nonsense. All that stuff the apostles preach, it doesn't work in real life. That's good for Sunday. What about the real world? What about on Monday? When the real world starts, what Peter is saying to them is they have to understand the real world, the world we live in, is the world we have to live in by faith. And remember, again, he's talking to people who are suffering. And that gets me to my last, final point, the how-to. It's great news. Because Peter doesn't just say, humble yourself and then leave it up to them. He doesn't. He says, humble yourself, and then he says, here is 100%. You might be into sports. 110%. Here's how you do it in your life. Right? So he doesn't say, humble yourself, and then leave it up to them to sort of talk it out and think, well, here's what I got to do. I need to do this. I need to do that. It might be true. He says, here, humble yourself, and here's how you do it. It's really good. You don't even have to figure it out. Because there's not two things here. He doesn't say, listen to what he says. He says, humble yourself, that's verse 6. Then verse 7 says, casting all your anxieties on him because he cares for you. But Peter's not saying two things. He's not saying, humble yourself, period, command number 1. Here's command number 2 that seems to not be connected at all with humbling yourself. Cast your anxieties on God. Otherwise, those two things don't even make sense together. Okay, he's like, fine, I'll do both of them, I guess. That's great, Peter, thanks. So I got to humble myself. I'm already suffering under other things. So I got to humble myself. Figure out how to do that. I guess I'll just be quiet. Keep my mouth shut. Yes, I can. It's hard, but I'll do it. And then after I've done that, I'll cast my cares on God. No, there's not two things here. There's one thing and how to do it. Here's how it goes. Humble yourself under the mighty hand of God by casting all your anxieties on Him. That's how you humble yourself. You humble yourself by holding your hands open and looking at God and saying, I can't do it. I can't carry these. These are going to kill me. I already feel like they've killed me. I've already given up. I can't carry them. And that's why God is standing there with His hands wide open, the hands that created the universe, the hands that raised Jesus from the dead, the hands that seated Jesus on the throne, says, I can't. Just think, look at my track record. That's how you humble yourself. You humble yourself by saying, I can't do it. I can't fix myself. I can't even humble myself. You do it by saying, this is too much for me. Now, some of you, all of us, 100% of us, don't like to hear that. Some people, it makes them mad when you talk this way. It might be making you mad right now. You might be hearing, oh, I can do it. I've always done it. Have you? Have I? Really? Is that why all of our problems go away so quick? No, they don't. We can't do this ourselves. But God can. Here's another question. Why would we even want to carry our own burdens and anxieties? If God says, I'll carry them. Like, yeah, that's what He wants to do. That's what He wants to do. Now, don't mishear me. I'm not saying for one second that you read this text, take it seriously, that all of your problems, poof, are going to go away. Because that's not faith. Right? Faith is believing this in the midst, again, of all kinds of stuff that says, I don't know. I mean, it sounds good and all, but I mean, look at all these things. And just because Peter's writing to people who are suffering, that doesn't mean that it doesn't include suffering for the sake of Jesus. That doesn't mean that this doesn't include all your troubles. Because he says all your anxieties, not some of them, not just the big things, all. And all just means all. Whatever you got, what do you got today? What anxieties do you have today? It is not too big, and don't fall in this trap, it's not too little for God to care about. Because it's always easy to say, well, you know, it's bad, but I mean, they got it worse over, you know, wherever. Of course they do. Somebody's always got it worse than you do. Usually, sometimes it doesn't seem like that. Sometimes you have it worse than everybody else. But it's not about how big or little a thing is. It's about whether you trust that God cares for you enough to do something about it. That's what it is. And even it doesn't matter what it is. It could be anything. It could be children who are unbelievers. It could be worry and concern over family members who are sick. It could be grieving because all of a sudden you had a human being in your life and they're gone and now there's a big open hole that we call grief. That people tell you, you'll get over it. Really? How? It's a person. How am I going to get over a person? I can't get over a person. There's a hole in my life. You know, I used to be a person. Right? You never get over losing somebody. You just don't. Not if you love them. You can't replace that. Just get over it. But you live by trusting in God. That God cares about that. What if you might be looking for a job? You might be looking for a different job. You might not be able to, you might have no idea how you're going to be able to pay the bills this month. You might already miss your bills. It could be any number of things. None of those are things that God looks at and says, well, you've got to fix that yourself. I mean, I'm on the big picture. Right? You need to fix these little things yourself. Right? I don't got time for that. God is not us. He's not nitpicky. And He's not always trying to teach us some lesson. He's there because He loves us. He gave His Son for us. And this could, even these anxieties can, and hear me well, these anxieties can even include and do include the anxiety you have in your life that's your own fault or your own guilt from sin. Me too. I keep saying you, but you have to understand, like, I may as well be looking in a mirror. Right? I mean, I could just have a gigantic mirror up here and everything I'm saying to you, I say to myself. But even the anxiety you feel from ongoing sin and temptation in your life that you keep failing at, those are anxiety. That is included in all the anxiety. So don't think for a second, man, I've done this so many times, I can't even go to God again. That's the one guarantee you have that that problem is not going to get fixed. Because what you're thinking is, God's not going to hear me, I better do something myself. Or you think, I've got to get this sin out of my life, then God will hear me. Really? We do that because that's the trick of the devil to make us think, to keep us in our sin. What if God said, the only people I'm going to save are the people who take care of their sin problem first? then I'll send my son for those folks. Heaven would not be a very populated place, except in the Trinity, right? Which would be massive, right? But you know what I'm talking about. None of us would be there. If God only helped those who help themselves, that'd be it. So whatever you're feeling right now, whatever you're being crushed by right now, and you might be doing relatively well right now. You might be doing well. I hope that you are. But there's always things in our lives. There's always things. And if we're doing well, we have to be careful that we don't turn all those blessings into burdens, and we don't just sort of start taking those things for granted. But whatever it is right now, don't feel like, I've gone to God with this so many times, I'm ashamed to go again. God never says, I got a limit on how many times you can come to me. Because you know who knows better than anybody else that there is no limit to the times you can go to God? It's God. There's never a time you go to God that He says, you again? I thought we went over this yesterday. Didn't I teach? What did I tell you about this? One more time, it's at the woodshed or wherever you go. I don't know. Woodshed, that might not make any sense to you. One more time, I can punish you there. That's what I mean by that. Right? We think God's that way. We think He's just out to get us all the time. He's not. He's out to save us. And the problem is we don't believe it. But we can believe it. Open yourself up to this text. This is the last thing I said. I want you to look at the end of this text and just look at what it says. Casting all your anxiety to Him. Why? So He can be like, all right, whatever. Do this again. No. Is it because He's begrudging? He's like, okay. So this is the last time, though. Next time, you're done. You've written all your checks. No, that's not what it says. We got to believe what the Word says. And the Word says, because He cares for you. You might think right now that He doesn't. You might feel like nobody's cared for you forever. You might have good reason to feel that way. But what the text here says, what God is saying to us, is He cares for us. And so that's what you need to say to yourself right now, is I don't understand it. I don't see it. I can't see through the grief and pain in my life. I can't see through the sin in my life. But God cares for me. And He cared enough to me to send His Son for me. And if He sent His Son for me, He cares enough to see me through to the end. And you hold on by faith in spite of all those things. And stop telling yourself, I'm going to fix it. Stop telling yourself, I'm a tough guy, I can do it. You can't. You can't. And that's the good news is God can. And He does. And He wants to. And He will. Just say it. God cares for me. Just hear yourself say it. God cares for me. Right? He's not against you. He is for you. And if you're here today and you're not a believer, you might hear this and think, there's this Christian talking about, I can't do this, I can't do that, I can't do this. That's exactly right. That's what we said. It's exactly right. I'll stand up and shout it from the mountaintop. I cannot fix myself. I cannot make my life better. And the ultimate proof is, one day I'm going to die. And I cannot stop that from happening. No matter how tough I might think I am. Something's eventually going to get them. But God steps into all this and says, I give my Son so that you can live. And so if you're here today and you're not a believer, I'm not going to try to tell you all your cares, poof, gone. And you're just like, you know, one cloud nine. But God is here to say, I'm for you. He is for you. You might think there's nobody for you, but God is for you. He's not against you. He's against His enemies. And one day we will have to stand before God as the God who is against us because of unbelief. But today, as long as we can call it a day that we live in, God has His hands wide open and offers life in His Son for any who would believe.